back to episode 216 of the Tall Boy Radio Podcast. And as we always say, who knows where it goes when the beer flows? Well, we've got a very exciting episode for you tonight. Gazza?
Yeah, looking forward to this. Evening all, evening the world. I say it most weeks, and it seems like I've been saying it for a while. You know, I enjoy having guests onto our podcast, and in particular guests that we've not had on before. So I'm really, really, really looking forward to this. And there's a couple of really burning questions that I really, really, really want to ask. But I'm going to leave it to our guest to introduce himself and talk a little bit about what he does, and then I'll get into the nitty-gritty of what I want to ask.
Indeed, indeed. So, without further ado, Alec, did you want to say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello, Alec Hirschfeld. Very happy to be on the podcast. I'm a retired cinematographer. Got into the business through nepotism. My dad was a cinematographer, famous for, among others, Young Frankenstein. I got sort of working for him in TV commercials, and then went on my own way to television shows. Actually, first it was feature films, because you're traveling around the world and it's easier for a young person. When I became, when I got married and started having a family, I gravitated toward TV and stayed with TV, particularly the Law and Order shows up until I retired.
Very, very well-known TV series that no doubt our viewers will have heard of and probably will have watched because it was available here in the UK as well. So, as well as all that, you found the time to write a book about your experiences as well recently, which is, Gaz, if you want to hold it up to the camera, What the Camera Didn't See by Alec Hirschfeld, which is available on Amazon. There you go, snap.
There you go.
Very nice, very nice. So, yeah, we will stick a link on our website. We'll stick a link on the audio of the episode when it goes out, because that is, generally speaking, the most popular version of it. So people can pick it up if they want to do so, which I would definitely recommend that they did. So first, the burning question, Gaz, that you wanted to ask was, really?
How the hell did you get into a scene where you're kissing Jamie Lee Curtis, dude? I mean, come on, talk to me about that. I mean, that is amazing.
He's talking about the cover. It's Jamie
absolutely.
Lee.
Well, I mean, you can tell us about anything that happened that wasn't on the cover. I mean, that's absolutely fine. Well, you say that, you know, you're a married man and all that stuff. But yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis, I mean, come on, dude.
Well, first of all, the window that we're sitting in, she's sitting in, is part of a set. So that's a set inside of the studio. So it's not real.
And right.
We had finished, I just finished lighting this, but she was going to be sitting there for the shot. In order to get a proper light reading, I couldn't just walk up to the window, because in a wider shot, we had phony plants and a little garden. So I had to go into the phony house and come out to the window so I could pull up my light meter. And there she was. And I just looked at her, and she looked at me, and she smiled and kind of reached over, and I reached over, and someone took the picture. I think it was probably the set photographer, maybe named N.J. Elliott. I didn't know the picture was being taken. It was just an impromptu moment. Jamie Lee had a copy of the photo, and she gave it to me on the wrap day with the
wow. An amazing photo, and yeah, like, what an icon, an absolute icon. I mean, there's a couple of people that, and we're going to get into the nitty gritty in terms of sort of who you've worked with and this, that, and the other, but you know, Jamie Lee Curtis is an amazing actress, and actually, you know, is incredibly sexy. So yeah, I doff my cap to you, sir.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it was I was in the right place at the right time. I went to her house. If you want to stay with the Jamie Lee subject for a while,
hey, you can stay there all you want. That's fine by me.
All right, let me see. This is in the book, so I'm plagiarizing myself, I guess. But before we started shooting the film, which was called Love Letters, and it was the first film that, this was going to be the first film that Jamie Lee did outside of the horror genre. At that point, she was the queen of Scream in Los Angeles. And we had this low-budget film that was being produced by Roger Corman. They hired Jamie Lee as a hopefully guarantee some box office. She's very, you know, obviously she's second generation Hollywood persona.
Yeah.
Father Tony Curtis and mother Janet Leigh. So she had the sense to want to meet her cinematographer before going into production, because she had some, she wanted to have some input in how I did the lighting, which was, as a cinematographer, director of photography, the lighting was my responsibility, among other things, but
yeah,
lighting in particular. And this is one of the things that actresses clearly are concerned with, because bad lighting makes you look bad. No way around that. So she said, come on over. She has a nice little house we did then in Santa Monica, outside of LA. And so I went over, we introduced, met each other. She takes me to the bathroom where she stands in front of the mirror. I'm behind her so I can see. And she turns on the overhead light and it kind of comes down and goes in her eyes and gives her the cheekbones. And she looks good. Just from the light over the mirror in the bathroom. And I turn that off, and she has a little light over beside her. It's a little lower. Turns that on, and it lights up all in her throat. Doesn't look so good. So that was lesson one. And we talked about lighting and approaches to the song. I tried to sound like I really knew what I was talking about, because this was my first movie as a director of photography. She had to excuse herself at one point, and I was in a room I called the den. Wooden panel, very nice. And as I walked into the room, I saw a line of Polaroid photos, right across the wall, about 10 feet worth. And then maybe another 6 feet worth under that, another strip of photos. You could think like little bitty wanted posters, perhaps. You get up and take a closer look, and I see that each photo has a man standing facing the camera, naked, with his feet spread out wide, head to toe shot, designed to show off or not show off, depending on the case, his package. So I look at it, and it's a different guy in every picture, but it's exactly the same pose. And as I look out the window, I see all the photos were taken just over there. Things started going off in my head, light bulbs started to go off. And this is Jamie Lee's trophy wall.
Yeah.
And I was invited to wait in this room for her. So I can only imagine that I'm going to be the next entrant. Something now, I know it's Jamie Lee Curtis, and I was a guy, you know, in my late 30s or so. Or maybe early 40s, I don't want to lie about my age. But generally, this would be an opportunity that you wouldn't want to walk away from. But I was so caught up in doing the job, not getting anything complicating my first movie as a director of photography, that I just said, it's really great meeting you, and I can't wait to, we will shoot some tests next week, and I think I have to go back to the studio now. And I left.
No, you left.
I left.
Oh, Alec, what are you doing, man?
I know. Right? You know, let me call it dedication to my art.
Yeah. Well, I think you did there what most people probably wouldn't have done.
Definitely wouldn't have done. Back, I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis, dude.
Yeah, man.
And you know, I mean, I didn't really have a clue what was going to happen next.
No, but I bet you can imagine, though.
Yeah.
I bet you can imagine.
Well, I didn't have to imagine, because later on in the movie, we had to do a shot where she's playing the piano, and she didn't in real life play the piano. So they got her a piano instructor, and he went to her house, as I did, to teach her on her. She had a piano there. And it was late. It was like middle of the film where I found out that he found himself in the same situation, but he did not walk away.
Okay.
He tinkled the ivory.
That's when I thought, oh my, did I blow that one?
Yeah.
And you're like this, you're like, no, 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 no.
Yeah.
I saw her in a screening a film at Los Angeles Film Exposition. I got to meet her mother, which was a thrill. But when it was over, I thought maybe I still had a chance. So there's a lot of hugging and kissing at the end of the screening for the cast and everybody. It's one big family. So I kind of held on to my embrace a little longer than either as long as would have been appropriate had my dreams about been about to come true. Or, and she let me know that, Hirschfeld, you're holding on a little too long.
Right.
And then that was the end of my non-affair with Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, man.
Wow. I was going to say, so, you know, did you ever, I mean, you've just told, obviously, the answer I was going to say, you know, did you ever work with her again? And then where she went, well, you had your chance. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could have, but not now, sunshine.
Yeah, it wouldn't be beyond her to say that, but no, she had mercy.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dude, that's a story. So if you've had a chance to look at the book before, if you're listening to this episode, if not, then maybe it's worthwhile. Well, not maybe, it's definitely worthwhile going and picking it up, because I've had a good chance to have a look through it. And you've been involved with a number of fantastic films that plenty of people out there will have heard of. And when I spoke to Vic, when you were guest on his podcast, obviously he mentioned a film that you were on. He mentioned a couple others. And because obviously the difference, I guess, in generations is different films appeal to different people. So the first film that really jumped out at me, Terminator. Do you want to tell us about working on there and Arnold and what have you?
That was a very memorable project. I can tell you, I'm going to go back to the first meeting before production, which is a boardroom table, nice long table. And we have our production managers and all the department heads. My job on Terminator was to operate a second camera. The director of photography would be operating his own camera, which is standard on non-union, lower-budget films, at least it was back then. Because it's a bone of contention sometimes, is the director of photography and camera operator two separate jobs. They don't have to be, but the more complicated the production, the better it is to separate those positions. It's just for division of labor being more efficient. At any rate, I'm digressing. I was there to be the D camera, which didn't come to work every day, but it's all on all the big scenes, anything with a truck blowing up or anything with the Terminator, they'd always have two cameras on. So I was at the meeting, but my director of photography and almost everyone else was a department head. I was the only one that wasn't actually a department head. And the production manager then introduces Jim Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd, his wife. He was the writer and director, and she was the producer. And we started talking about what the demands of the film were going to be, and we all introduced ourselves first. And as we were introducing ourselves, we found something that the most unusual thing for anybody was the sense that we had read a hit film. Normally, a crew reading the script for the first time is going to look for, okay, how much is day? How much is night?
Yeah.
You know, how much is this going to screw my life up? Is this story any good at all? Am I going to be ashamed that I worked in this movie? But this time, everybody's looking, this is a hit. If we all do our jobs, this can't miss. It's not good a story. And I'm going to go take an aside as I'm just recalling. It's a time travel movie, but it wasn't always, in James Cameron's thinking, it wasn't always, he wanted it to be a futuristic piece. But right. As it turned, doing the whole thing in the future was going to be way too expensive than I think it was a $6 or $7 million budget, which is a lot of money, but a low budget for a film like that. It was too expensive to do the whole thing with all the futuristic sets and everything. So we said, okay, I'll write it for the present, and we'll bring the future back to the active now. So that was that major, major script choice was a financial decision. But back to the meeting, we're all like just dumbfounded that we could be on a film like this. And then they started telling us about how tough it would be working in some pretty nasty locations. Lots of night work, fire, pyrotechnics, lots of gunfire. Gunfire is inherently dangerous on a set.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a bit of a controversy on the Alec Baldwin.
Literally, I've just looked at Adam and go, the Alec Baldwin, absolutely.
While I'm on the subject of danger, I'll relate an incident that did occur on the Terminator in the police precinct where the Terminator first kind of shows up and looking for, I can't remember her name, but Linda Hamilton.
Let's play John Connors.
Sarah Connor.
Sarah Connor.
Sarah Connor, very good. So you shoot Arnold as the Uzi going off, if it was working.
Right.
I'd say at the time it would jam, and an Uzi expert would have to come running in and unjam it and put new blanks in. And then you have to do basically his point of view, which is a room getting all shot up, and people getting shot up. So we were in that room, two cameras set up, shooting, let's just say, part of the scene that takes place on the left side of the room. So they weren't going to blow up anything on the right side of the room. But the walls had all been, had little marks dug out of them and a little tiny explosive charge put in there and then recovered and repainted. And all those wires go down to the floor, under the carpet, and out of the set to a guy with a little circuit board. And it's almost like he's playing the piano, setting off these little explosions. Unfortunately, that day, the art department had to go in and change the furniture around. And when they did, they moved the wires. So roll the camera, the action starts, and it's time to set off the squibs, the little explosions, and bang, 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 a whole bunch of them go off, but none of them go off on camera. They all go off to the side, just out of shot. And my camera assistant was probably a foot away from the wall, and she had to go home. She wasn't seriously injured, but she had a big, like a big red mark where this explosion had gone off right. So it can be dangerous, and you tend to have, it tends to be actually a little more dangerous, I think, on a low budget movie, because you can't hire the very best, and you're always under time constraints. I'm not trying to criticize, you know, any department or anybody's work. Everyone does the best they can. Mistakes are more liable to be made when you aren't spending as much money.
Couple of things. So, firstly, I love the way that just a little bit earlier you sort of went Jim, and you were about James Cameron, and you just called him Jim, and I'm like, oh my day, like it's just Jim. That for me is like blows my mind. It's James Cameron. He's amazing.
Absolutely was.
Absolutely, yeah. And the second thing was, and it's only really just come to my mind, is that if you're shooting a scene that, you know, there's a series of explosives or gunfire or whatever, and you see it from a third person point of view, I suppose, and you can see the action, and then you see it from a first person point of view, that's two completely different shots. Mm. So you've got to be, I suppose, you've got to be so precise in terms of, and it's only really dawned on me now, because I would, my naivety would have assumed that like the actor would have held the camera, maybe, I don't know, and you've got a second camera shooting it from a third person point of view, and then the same camera in the same shot shooting it from a first person point of view, but actually what you're saying is it's just two completely different shots, so therefore you've got to match them up and then make sure that they actually look identical, which is then in the editing and all of that, which blows my mind, because you've got to make sure the charges are the same, the shots are the same, and the actions are the same. And that's like, wow, like incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting when you say that. That kind of matching is always very important. But if you have a scene where there's pandemonium and gunfire and people running, you actually have more leeway to not be precise. Where you have to be precise is a meal scene. If you have six people at the dinner table.
Right.
And they're going to, in the course of the scene, they're going to probably go from the beginning of the meal to the end of the meal. That's a whole day's worth of work.
Really?
Work. And the actor then is, because this is really going to be cutting person to person to person, if you picked up, you took your fork and hit it and stuck it into a potato when you were saying, I don't know what's going to happen next year, and then you took a bite, you have to do it. The actor has to do it that way. Every time, all day, the dialogue has to match the action, because if you didn't, it'd be very apparent very quickly.
There'd be loads of continuity error. Oh, did you see that? Like, and there's loads of things that you'll see people and they'll say like, oh, in that shot, I don't know, they're smoking a cigarette and it's like full, And then in like a second later, the cigarette is like half full. And you're like, yeah, they're the continuity errors. Because obviously lots of people sort of look for those things. But and I've never really thought about actually, you know, I'll watch film and go, oh, well, that's a bit weird. That didn't look right. But then thinking about from being behind the camera, the absolute intricate like detail that you have to think about various shots. And if you're shooting a similar scene over a period of time, those shots have to be absolutely exact, you know, or like identical.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Like a moving jigsaw.
There's one person whose job that is, the script supervisor.
Right.
That person is really takes notes, very careful notes. When did the actor get up out of the chair? Was he talking? Or did he talk after he got up? You know, when did the fork get moved to the mouth?
Wow.
And those things.
And does that person then relay that back to the camera people in terms of when you shoot or what you shoot? Or do you literally just like roll the camera and then it goes to the editing floor and they just cut and chop and do whatever they do?
Well, yeah, it actually can go both ways. Most scenes are shot with a wider shot and then a couple right. of close-ups, and then maybe there's a movement. And the editors put that together, and the editors can really kind of control the pacing of the scene.
Right.
A more courageous way to go for some directors is to do what they call a one-er.
Yeah.
And you see this a lot on Law and Order shows on TV, for instance, where one shot will follow an actor, he's talking, and then the other actor walks in, and you follow him while he's talking, and he takes you around, back to the first actor again, and you do the whole scene in one shot.
Wow.
Not only does it take a certain amount of courage, but you can, you know, it can fall apart. If it falls apart right at the end, it doesn't matter because the whole take is no good. You know?
Yeah. Wow. Has there been an occasion where maybe you've been filming, like, you know, you one shot take and actually in your mind you're thinking, oh my god, this is like a right shit show, it's going to, but your job is just to film it and it's up to somebody else to sort of pick the pieces up as such? But you know, has there been a time where you've gone, oh my god, this is really bad, but I'm just going to keep filming anyway? Or have you got the opportunity to go, no, let's stop this because that's a shit show?
That has to do with your relationship with the director.
Right. Oh, okay.
Directors, yep. I have been chewed out more than once for cutting the camera because I thought I saw the shot go bad. And the
right.
director, it's not your job to cut the camera.
I really? Wanted to see
or for whatever reason.
Ah.
I even got in trouble once for cutting on a scene that was being done as a one-er. In other words, if we had something go wrong in the beginning, why go do the rest of it? It's not going to be any good. I cut the camera because a piece of equipment came into the top of frame. You know, one of those flags dropped in. As I cut, the director, producer came and chewed me out.
Really?
So much. On the other hand, in TV shows, particularly where you have directors that are coming and going, so the real consistency is with the actors.
Right.
I have a relationship with the actors. They don't want to do anything that's not going to be wasted. So if I cut, I've been thanked for that.
Right.
And now, when we're talking about, I want to add on to something in the subject of matching. As I've said, it's a script supervisor whose job it is to make sure that the action matches. The dialogue matches the physical action. What comes under the director's purview more than that is matching the emotional level of a film.
Yeah.
Which is a little touchier. But imagine, and this does happen, you're shooting a shot outside. Say it's a walk and talk. Two people are walking on the sideway talking, camera's backing up, and they turn and go into a building. So in the camera just sees them go in. The next shot is from inside that building and they're continuing the speech. But it could have been 2 weeks since you did the outdoor shot and then you finally got to the location for the indoor shot. Might have been 2 weeks later. Now, the wardrobe department will know to match the wardrobe and the makeup department will make sure they look the same. If the hair was a little messy from the wind, okay, the hair will still be a little messy. But the actors might not have remember the exact emotional context.
Yeah.
How angry they might have been or how sad they might have been or how deadpan they might have been. And so that's they're going to look to the director, given that note.
It's just that sort of minutiae. It's that like minute detail. And yes, everybody talks about that, as I said earlier, you know, sort of continuity errors and this, that, and the other. But it's that you never really think that a scene from the outside where an actor or actress walks in through a door and then it cuts to the shot from inside, you never really make the connection that actually that could be 2-3 weeks later.
If you even suspect it, then we have failed as a filmmaker.
Yes, absolutely. And the only thing for me was that, and I remember reading something about Peter Jackson and the Lord of the Rings trilogy and this and the other, and what they did was apparently, and they sort of shot different scenes from each of the three films, almost like they didn't shoot all of the first film and then all the second film and all the third film. And when they had all the actors and actresses there, they go, well, we'll have this scene for film number one and we'll have this scene for film number three. I mean, talk about like a jigsaw and like putting like just mind blowing, absolutely mind blowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You just described what sounds to me like a nightmare. Sometimes in TV, we'll do what's called block shooting. If you are in a room and half the scenes are going to be shot this way, and the other half that way.
Yeah.
And but you have two more scenes to do in the same room. You might shoot scene one in this direction, scene two in this direction, and scene three in this direction, because you save so much time that you don't have to move back and forth. But directors want to do that because they can get in trouble on that, matching that emotional level. I'll give you one kind of an extreme example, maybe not as extreme as what you just spoken about, because that was three different movies. But in one movie that Martin Scorsese did that I didn't work on, called Cape Fear.
Yeah, great film, by the way.
Yeah, 3 months. 3 months after they had finished photography, Scorsese realized he needed a shot, and I don't remember the film that well, but he needed a shot of De Niro's hand coming up out of water.
Yes.
So like the camera's looking straight down into a river, and it's black, and there's some dirty stuff swirling around, and then his hand comes up.
Yeah.
That was a shot we did in a studio in New York, something like 3 months after they wrapped the movie. But he needed that one shot. And it's not easy to get, because first you have to build a pool.
Yeah.
And then you have to get the camera somehow over the pool, looking straight down. So it was a day of building that setup, and then fill the whole thing up with water. And then it has to be the right temperature water, because an actor has to go in there and go underwater, hold his breath, and put his hand down, and put his hand up, and then while the camera's running. I'm like, a little complicated. I could understand why they didn't take the time to do it when they had all their actors and everybody, on set at the principal photography.
And that's again, you know, the more that you talk, Ali, it's more the more that you realize it literally is like, as Adam said, it's like putting bits together to create the final piece. And you see that scene where the hand comes out the water, and then you think, okay, so they will have just done that in a bloody stream or river or something. No, that's like a swimming pool. But what they've had to do is they've had to then mock up that swimming pool to make it look like it's this and make it look like it's that. So they will have built that set for that one scene that one guy wants, and you're like, Jesus. And I suppose when you take that to the nth degree, you can sort of understand why sometimes budgets run away with themselves, because you think, well, we need this shot, or we need this shot, and all of a sudden we need this, and all of a sudden it's like that one scene where that hand comes out of the water, it isn't just as simple as, you know, an actor maybe, okay, freezing his tits off for 15 minutes underwater and just doing it in a stream or a river, but it's actually going into a swimming pool, you know, mocking up the swimming pool to make it look like it, to then making sure the temperature's right, then making sure the lighting is all right, et cetera, et cetera.
It's actually not a real swimming pool. It's a pool that we built inside of a studio, because it had to be small to get a rig to go over it so the camera could look straight down.
So it's not even a swimming pool.
Yeah.
Wow. It's mad, isn't it? It's mad.
It's artwork, isn't it, really?
It is.
It's an art form. So, yeah, you mentioned that, obviously, you didn't work on Cape Fear. However, you have had the opportunity to work with a Mr. Robert De Niro and a Mr. Martin Scorsese on a number of occasions, haven't you?
Yes, earlier in my career, particularly. Scorsese, Marty was a professor at NYU.
Marty. Just like Marty. It's not Marty, it's Marty.
Yeah.
Brilliant, love that.
On his set today, I'm sure he still goes by Marty. I can't imagine he'd insist on Martin. De Niro, a little different. He was Bobby on set all the time on Taxi Driver and Mean Street. Yeah. But then I did run into him some 15 or 20 years later when I was shooting for a TV show called Entertainment Tonight. And that was one of these shows where they interview celebrities.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was uncovered for his stuff, and I didn't really have very much time to talk. We get it all set up, and then they bring him out, and we shoot, and then he goes, they take him away. But then when we were done, we both happened to be out in the hallway waiting for the elevator. So I said, Bobby. And he looked at me like, who the hell is this guy calling me Bobby? Well, I had to go up to him, and the last time he'd seen me, I had shoulder length hair. And a big beard. So now at Entertainment Tonight, I'm a little more cleaned up. And I said, yeah, I was on Taxi Driver, your assistant. But more than that, you should remember on Mean Streets, we did a shot of you on a rooftop where they set me up with a camera and a light, one light. And I set it up and you come up and you do like this and then you disappear. Wow. We didn't even have a director with us. It was just me and my assistant, one light. And a guy with a walkie-talkie said, okay, bring Bobby up. So when he remembered that, then I knew I was okay to call him Bobby.
Yeah, after that you were fine. But before that, he's like, who's this guy?
Brilliant. Yeah. Love that.
Yeah. Marty, though, Marty is Marty. And so I met him first at NYU. I sadly didn't have any classes with him, although I did have classes with a man named Haig Manoogian, who's in the book, was Scorsese's mentor. So this guy was, Haig Manoogian was the iconic East Coast film instructor, film academic. And he recognized something in Scorsese. Not only did he encourage Martin Scorsese's career, he actually, Haig Manoogian, the professor of film, mortgaged his house in order to finance a movie called Who's That Knocking, which was Martin Scorsese's first feature film.
Wow.
So I went back that far with Marty. When they came into town to do Mean Streets, this was after Marty had gone to Los Angeles on a low-budget Roger Corman film. He had the script that he had co-written. They came back to do Mean Streets. It was done as a non-union film, another low-budget movie. I mean, very low budget. I think it was $600,000. Can you imagine? The second unit, before the principal photography started, they needed a second unit of the Italian street fair, the San Gennaro Festival. And I was chosen to do it just because I was a familiar face from NYU. And I had a little experience given my background. So I got to shoot all of the Italian street fair. And my proudest moment, I think, for Mean Streets is one that I really had very little to do with. But if you remember the film, the last shot is of a looking up at a tenement window. And as the credits start to roll and you hear the music from the street fair, someone comes and pulls the shade down, which is just like the curtain dropping on a play.
Yeah.
And my part in that was simply to say, let's put a brighter light bulb in the apartment. And Marty said, yeah, there's the window. And I tipped up and he said, roll it. And I rolled the camera and I looked through. The whole idea was, Scorsese. But as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, this is great. This is such a fine touch. And it wasn't until I started working on the book that I realized that Marty had gotten the idea from someone else. Another New York movie called On the Waterfront.
Okay.
Brando, directed by Ilya Kazan, who was, I think, a hero in Scorsese. the end of that movie, when the credits start to roll, this all takes place on the docks of the waterfront in New York. When the credits starts to roll, big corrugated garage door. And the credits roll up as the garage door goes down. So I think Marty was reprising that technique on Mean Street.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive.
Between Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, I was very fortunate to have Marty ask me to shoot a movie about his parents called Italian American. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
And was that like a was that like a personal request then? Like, you know, I like your work. Would you please do this for me? So how did that come about as such?
I get a call from either a producer or an assistant director saying, Marty would like to come in and talk to you about shooting this documentary.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen Marty for a while. Actually, before that was Mean Streets, I guess. My second units. So, yeah, Mean Street, by then, Mean Streets had been released. So I got to say I was thrilled to see my various little shots on the street fair and Mean Streets. And then Marty said, he mentioned a film that I had, the documentary that I had recently done for an NYU student, a film called No Lives. And we talked about a one-er. This one was one roll of film, 400-foot film in the camera. And we shot the movie from beginning to end on the one roll of film.
Wow.
Yes. So, but there's also no dialogue. We improvised the whole thing. I'm not going to go, I won't go into that story because we're on Scorsese. But Marty had seen it because he was still connected to NYU. And he knew that he wanted to have that kind of freedom with the camera. So he said, he complimented me on the thing that I had done for Mitchell, my friend.
Yeah.
And he said he wanted me to have the freedom to do the same kind of thing. And then we shot in his parents' apartment for 2 days. An awful lot of it was actually the two of them sitting on the couch. And Marty's next to me reminiscing, getting them to tell stories. So I didn't just hold a wide two shot. I had Marty gave me the flexibility to move into a close-up on his mother, if I felt, and then pan to his father. Normally, you think you just follow the dialogue, but sometimes you want to go to the person who's listening.
Yes, sure.
Which is tricky. And I'd be always kind of taking my chances and biting my tongue because you're hoping that nothing really important gets said. Otherwise, you're going to have to go back. You don't want to get caught. But what I discovered after the film came out and I saw it and I thought, as I'm watching this, half the time, I'm on the wrong person. I should have waited to pan. And then I started talking to another script supervisor who was just seeing it. She said, no, you were fine. You got to remember that the audience watching the film tends to believe that you're doing everything that you're doing on purpose. The audience doesn't know that no one told you when to pan or didn't tell you when to pan. They think that you're following some kind of instruction, and that's where the camera belongs. So no one thinks you made a mistake.
And I assume just prior to you shooting that, you know, Marty, as you say, Mr. Scorsese, as myself and Adam would say, would you like to shoot this for me? Nah, you're all right. I'll give it a miss. It's fine, thanks. I've got another project on the go. You know, I'm assuming that you just jumped at the chance and went, like, hell yeah.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. You don't say no to him, do you? I'm assuming. I mean, I don't know. I've never met the guy.
You said no to Jamie Lee Curtis.
No, with Marty, it was when he says, come on in, we want to talk to you, I'm pretty sure that I have the job already.
So yes, yeah. If he asks for you, then you're pretty confident that actually he's asked for you for a reason, and therefore, yeah, absolutely. Pretty secure.
Great compliment. Yeah, it's a great compliment, that is.
While we're on Italian-American, there was one time at the very end of the film where Scorsese gave me a very specific camera direction.
Yeah.
So we're shooting, it's the last scene of the last day in their apartment. And I'm just on his mother, and he's going to be just asking her if there's any other stories she wants to tell, and or what's the time we're going to go have dinner, because she's making sauce. She's making dinner during this whole process. So she's standing and rolling camera. Marty leaned over to me and says, "Don't cut. At the end, when I say cut, keep rolling." So, okay. So I'm down to the camera. He says cut. I sort of pick my eye up a little bit to pretend like we've cut.
Yeah.
I know the camera's rolling. And his mother's now, she's like, no more pressure. She's a little more, so she's relaxed. She's glad. Oh, the shooting is done. Blah, 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 blah. And then she looks at me because I've got my eye down in the camera again. She says, "Is she still filming this?" And then Scorsese says, "Zoom into a close-up." I zoom in the close-up and she says, "I'll kill him. You'll never leave this apartment alive."
Brilliant.
I hope I don't get stabbed. You got a fork between the eyes, whatever it was. But no, it was fine. And then she made us all spaghetti and meatballs.
No, nice.
And we had actually, in the course of the filming, she'd gotten up from the couch, gone to the kitchen to check the sauce. Why don't you go with her? Because this is why I think seen that previous movie I made. So we all cram into a 4x4 kitchen. He says, "It's okay to see the equipment. I don't mind. Actually, I want to see the equipment. People will have to know. People know we're making a film here. See the equipment. It's no problem." And then at the end of the movie, the sauce recipe gets a credit.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, genius. Absolute genius.
And you can see it on YouTube. Italian-American.
I'll have a look for that. Yeah, so when I picked up your book, as I said, you know, obviously we've heard these fantastic stories about Robert De Niro, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jamie Lee Curtis. But the first chapter I turn to is chapter 16, because I love B-movies. Can you tell us a little bit then? Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about the difference between working on a major film project and working on a B-movie, and what's that like? And second of all, just a story there about the nude scene when you're filming that. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Yes. You know, we've kind of touched on this a little bit. The lower budget movies will tend to be non-union, and you're hiring people that are recently out of film school, people that are trying to, you know, get their foot in the door. So you don't have a lot of experience on the set. So that can, ironically, that can sometimes slow things down, because you have to do it again, and it might be a mistake. You can make up for that mistake. What other differences? Well, certainly the pay scales are quite different.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
On low budget movies, the crew doesn't get, you know, it's all, if you're not on the union, then you're not getting retirement funds, you're not getting your health insurance. But that's probably okay, because those non-union crews are younger. So they don't need the health insurance quite that way.
Yeah.
You know, the B in B-movies, that stands for budget. And in Hollywood, they had the A movies and the B movies. The B movies weren't non-union. They were just lower budget movies. And a lot of films that we think are quite classics were B movies. I think some of Humphrey Bogart's films were. It doesn't mean they weren't A class. It just means they were budget movies.
Yeah.
Well, did you want to tell us then about the story from the book about, like you say, the difference between, say, when you're filming a scene which involves nudity in a larger budget movie, and what it's like on a budget set?
Well, even on Roger Corman's film with Jamie Lee Curtis, she had some nudity in that. And because most of us working on a film had background in bigger and more tightly organized films, that set was treated in a very respect, but with a lot of respect for the actors who are going to be nude.
Yeah.
So what I'm usually trying to do then is make sure that there's no one on the set who doesn't have to be on the set to do the actual shot. You know, you may have if you have a crew of 40 people, really you need 10 of them or 6 of them when the camera rolls. You don't need electricians and prop people. Probably. You need one prop person. But maybe you need one electrician if there's a special light. But for the most part, it's the director, the cameraman, the assistant cameraman, the script supervisor, and the assistant director. That'll be about it. And so it says, everybody who doesn't have to be here, please clear the set. Another way they put it is the bad way to put it is all non-essential personnel are invited to leave the set. Because then no one stands up. No one wants to stand up. Everybody likes to think they're important. But if it's anybody who doesn't have to be here, and then everybody gets up. The film I did for Canon Films, which was sort of a factory of low-budget movies back in the 80s, it was pretty much the opposite. They had a scene, a girls' high school gym, public high school gym, the girls' locker room. And they're supposed to be taking showers. And then the two stars of the movie, teenage boys, they're outside of a wall that's because they cut a hole in it. And they're, so that's the basic scene. The reality was, it's a false wall. You can walk around it.
Right.
But you see the part it's supposed to see. And rather than having a clear set, all I can imagine was that somebody called the production office and said, "Hey, everybody, come on down. They're going to be naked." Because I never saw, and they're all, everybody's in there with their suits and ties and white shirts, all undone. And they take it off their jackets and they came down on a Friday night for a show. And they're all elbowing, look at that. I was almost disgusted. I just couldn't believe it. The bottom line was none of the people on camera seemed to mind. They all thought it was fine, giggling and having fun being naked. So I guess no harm done.
Nah, it's crazy. I mean, you've obviously had a life that is very different to props that you and I, some of those experiences that you had. I've certainly never been around Jamie Lee Curtis's house and had that opportunity. But what's been the highlight? When you look back on your career, what are the bits that you remember the most?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. One of the most memorable moments I had as an assistant cameraman on my second movie, first movie I'd done in the United States, first full Union crew, was a movie called The Incident.
Right.
Which took place in a subway car. The stars were Martin Sheen and Tony Nusante. And they play two hoodlums who jam the doors of the subway car so nobody can get out. And then they step by step terrorize different people on the train or different couples on the train. And one of the first couples they go after is an African American couple. She was played by Ruby Dee, and he was played by an actor named Brock Peters. Brock Peters became well known because he was in the film with Gregory Peck, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes. Yeah.
He's up on the witness stand, and he's a big guy, big, tough looking black guy. And the lawyer is kind of tearing him apart. I think he had been accused of something, whatever. But so I recognize him for that. But in our movie, he's established as having a grudge against white people. And he sees these hoodlums terrorizing other people in the train. And he says to his wife, I'm loving this. And then one of the bad guys hears that, and they turn his attention on them. The two guys go over and make their wisecracks, and they separate the couple. And now Brock Peters is in the position of wanting to save his wife, but knowing that if he makes a move, the other hoodlum is going to maybe break her arm or break her neck. Yeah. So he has the emotion started bubbling up out of the sky. And because I was the assistant cameraman, I'm standing right next to the lens of the camera, and I'm 3 feet away from him because we're very close to him, which the director wanted that immediacy. And I'm watching the tears roll down his eyes and the snot coming out of his nose as he's trying to contain himself as the character, but let all the emotion out as an actor. Yeah. And it affected me. I can still feel the pit in my stomach. When the director yelled cut, he ran into the scene and put his arms around Brock and hugged him. And the man was sobbing for 2 minutes. And you're trying to figure out what ring of hell did he reach down into to pull out this emotion.
Yeah.
I've been in a lot of, you know, scenes, I've seen a lot of great stuff, but I was never witness to something like that, so close, that had such an effect on me. After the director calmed down, it was like, I thought we time to, let's take a breath, let's talk about this. No, moving on, next shot.
Wow. Different world, yeah.
Isn't it? Just, you know, to elicit that feeling from other people, you know, the actor, the actress, and or whoever is in the scene, and for them to be so in character and in the moment, and to feel that, to then make other people on set feel as passionate and as emotional as you were, then that must be like an incredible moment as such.
Yeah, normally that moment would be followed by applause from the crew.
Yes.
But this particular moment, everybody just had their jaws hanging open.
Yeah.
Speaking.
Yeah.
No one said anything. No one could. Everybody was limp.
Wow.
Yeah.
It emptied me out.
Okay, yeah, I can imagine. So, guys, so this guy, like I say, in terms of all these fantastic movies that we've heard about, he actually took a little bit of break away from that, you know what I mean? So if he wasn't a cameraman, the other role that you were fulfilling then was you were a chartered boat skipper in the Caribbean.
Yeah. I always liked being on the water. And shortly after NYU, I think, I met someone who wanted to do a documentary on a sailboat.
Yeah.
This was a 100-foot schooner that belonged to a museum in New York, and they were using the boat. They were keeping the boat, a 100-year-old boat, more than a 100-year-old boat. They were able to keep it maintained and sailing by employing it as a vessel for a drug rehabilitation program. So they would take kids that are involved in rehab, and they would sail the boat for 2 weeks on the New England coast. And some of them would learn about sailing enough that they would then go to a marine training school and learn a career. So I went on with a partner on one of these two-week cruises to make a documentary. And I really fell in love with sailing. When we finished shooting the film and all the post-production, it was the middle of winter. My girlfriend wanted to go on vacation. And I was all for it. My partner in the film said, don't just go to a resort. Let's charter a boat in the Virgin Islands and sail around. Maybe we can get a magazine article published, which is exactly what we did. The connection was that we had made a documentary film on the sailboat, one apart for the museum. One of the board members was the editor of a sailing magazine. So they knew our photography. So it's at least our cinematography. So they said, yeah, take pictures, bring them back to us in our office. Maybe we'll do something for you. So it turned out they did an 8-page photo spread, which paid for the charter of the sailboat. My girlfriend said, let's do it again. And she had some cash. She said, well, we'll get our own boat, and we'll just keep doing that over and over again. Well, that'll be our new lives. So, okay, I said, okay, but I don't know how to sail. That might be a problem. So she didn't live that far. She bought a sailboat, and my partner from the film, the documentary, was a very good sailor. So he spent the summer teaching us how to sail our boat. That fall, we headed south down the intracoastal waterline, which is a series of inland canals and sounds and rivers that you can go practically from Virginia all the way to Florida without going out in the ocean, which is not a thing that we wanted to do during hurricane season.
Yeah.
Made it to the Bahamas, sailed around for a number of months, made out of money. We brought the boat back to New York, lived on the boat in a marina on the Hudson River. That summer, I worked on Taxi Driver. And then the following spring, we traded that boat in for a 19-ton schooner. Ultimately got that boat down to the Virgin Islands, which was American territory, which meant I could work because by then we're really out of cash, all out of money. And so I got a job at a hotel's dock, taking care of their boats. And one of the skippers of their charter boat said, you know, how did you get here? I said, I sailed down on a schooner. He said, why don't you have your license? I said, what, how do you do that? He says, well, you got to take the test over in San Juan. And then you can, instead of cleaning boats, you can sail them. And they'll pay you. They pay you to sail, and they'll pay for your boat, charter your boat. So it sounds like a great idea. So I got a book called The Coal Regs, Collision Regulations. You know, back book about this thing. It's like, and you just memorize the rules. Like, it's an example. What is the proper night light for a vessel that is underway but not making way? What the hell does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Yeah, that means that you're sailing or motoring in a current, and the current is equal to your speed, and it's coming in the opposite direction. So you're underway, but you're not making any movement over the ground. And the proper lighting, I think, for that is a red light over a white light up on your mast. I could be wrong about that, but I'm not sailing for convenient water, so no one's in danger. Once I got the license and had this big old schooner down there, we chartered it almost every day. Nice. That was my new job.
I just love the way that you said, yeah, you know, so we finished doing that, and then I worked on Taxi Driver. They're like, what? Like, as if that just falls into place. That's just naturally what you do. It's like, that's Taxi Driver, dude. That's like De Niro. That's like amazing. And my mind is blown and boggled by just your stories about, like, yeah, well, I did this, and then I did Taxi Driver, and then I met Marty, et cetera, et cetera. It's just like, I mean, what a fantastic life, fantastic, you know, sort of experiences that you've had, and just like an incredible story as such.
Would you like to hear the one other Taxi Driver story?
I'd love to hear a Taxi Driver story, please. Oh, just before we get to the Taxi Driver story, and I don't know the answer to this, and it can be as simple as a yes or a no. But I have to ask, obviously you've spent a lot of time being behind the camera. Have you ever sort of done a cameo? Have you been asked to be an extra in a film that you know, have you ever been in front of the camera?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you should ask, because the documentary I did where I mentioned that we ran one roll of film.
Yes.
No cut. That was a documentary about a woman who had been raped.
Right.
And they called the movie No Lies. And in it, it's the fact is that we staged it. We made it look like a cinema verite documentary, but we actually staged the whole thing. And I play the part of the filmmaker.
Right.
And the actress is like, it's just the two of us in her apartment. But we started the movie in a bathroom, and she's getting makeup on in the mirror, and I'm behind her. So I see myself in the mirror.
Right.
So that the director introduced the movie that way to show that we're this is a straight out cinema verite. We're actually showing you the camera. And from then on, I revised all the dialogue. We had rehearsed it days before on a video camera. So we had an idea what the territory was we were going to cover, but we never wrote down any of our dialogue. So I introduced myself in the mirror, but then you hear me asking her, badgering her, in fact, and almost eventually attacking her until she breaks down and starts to cry.
Wow.
I'm not a nice guy in the movie, but they had me playing not a nice guy.
Right. Completely opposite to what you actually are. Yeah, well, I get that.
Yeah, go on. Tell us the Taxi Driver story then.
Yeah.
This is maybe the most iconic scene in the film when he's in the mirror.
Yeah.
Say, you talking to me? Mm-hmm. Talking to me?
You talking to me? Yeah.
First of all, that almost wasn't done. The scene almost wasn't made because it wasn't scripted. And the script, it just says he looks at himself in the mirror.
Wow.
He's got all this, and he's just looking at, you know, he's got all his guns on. He's just looking at, that's all it said. So Bobby says to Marty, and I didn't hear this conversation. This was told to me. Says, what do you want me to do? And Marty says, and I did hear this, just do something. Do something.
Wow.
Camera up, facing the mirror just outside, just off angle enough so you don't see the lens. And he, Bobby, gets in the shot. And I'm on the other side of camera, but next to the lens. So when he's looking at the mirror, as far as I'm concerned, it feels just like he's looking at me. So I experienced that whole scene firsthand, eye to eye, even in a way that I wouldn't normally experience it as a camera assistant, because of the mirror.
Wow.
And when it was over, everybody went, whoa, you know, what was that? Then the next day, the next morning, we get an emergency call from the film lab. This is a call that takes place usually every day in the morning. You want the film laboratory, it doesn't happen in digital anymore. You want the film laboratory to tell you that the negative was okay. There's no problem with the film. And then eventually that night, you go to dailies, you can see what you've actually got. But this particular day, either the lab called or the office made the call and said, there was something wrong with the negative. It looks like it was flipped. It looks like maybe the camera assistant loaded it wrong and flipped it in the camera, which immediately tells you that the guys at the lab don't know anything about the camera we're using, because that can't be done. But I find myself that morning working on the camera, and like three producers come cover. What happened? What happened? They say, the lab called the flip, the image is flipped, and he said the negative was dirty and watermarks on it and everything. We're trying to figure out what's going on, and then the DP comes over, Michael Chapman, and he said, this is the mirror shot? You're talking to me shot? I said, yeah. Well, here's the mirror. It's flipped because we were shooting into a mirror.
Wow. But like, I can't believe it. That scene actually nearly never took place. B, I can't believe that basically you're there and he's sort of almost saying it to you. It's like, are you talking to me? Because like, he's almost looking at you and you're offset and you sort of in the mirror and so on. So that just blows my mind. I mean, that is an absolutely iconic, like, scene from a film. It's like, are you talking to me? It's just like, absolutely. Dude, amazing.
Genius, yeah. Well, to experience that first time, oh my days, I can't even imagine that, can you?
No, not at all. But, you know, to be there and to be in, and I don't know, and I suppose a question for Alec, maybe this podcast, maybe another one, I don't know, but, you know, to be in, when you're filming those scenes and you're filming those films, I suppose, do you realise that, in a way, you are in the presence of greatness? Because do you realise at the time that these are iconic actors and actresses, and De Niro and Jamie Lee Curtis and Arnie, and is Arnie an iconic actor? Probably, but blah, 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 blah. You know, but do you realise that you're in the presence of greatness? Is it something that you realise at the time? Is it only after the event that you think, shit, that was difficult?
After the event, after the fact. For one thing, I don't know if you could really be quite as effective at your job if you feel like you're dealing with royalty.
Like superstars or such. It's just, yeah.
You have to be able to say, nah, you know, that didn't look good. You know, Bobby, this is your mark. You're going to be out of focus. You know, you have to be able to converse freely.
And when when you're conversing with I suppose those actors, do you converse with the director to say he missed his mark, or would you go directly to the actor and go, well, I'm not being funny, Robert, you fucked that up, you know, sort your shit out, sort of thing, you know what I mean?
It depends on the project, and even could depend on where you are in the project. I might not know the actors, and so then I'm going to always go to the director and let him be the intermediary if I have anything for them. Yeah. But as time goes, and they might tell me, just come to me. Don't go to him. He's busy. Come to me and they'll let you know.
So we're just over the hour mark, which is where we like to wrap these things up. Alec, thank you very much for joining us. I tell you what, you can't even begin to imagine the things that his two eyes have seen and then he shared through the lens, can you?
No, not at all. And we haven't even really touched, like, famous scenes from famous films. I mean, we haven't even really talked about Terminator. I mean, I love that film, and we haven't even really started to even scratch the surface about what, you know, the certain lines and, you know, I want your boots, your car or bike or whatever it is. You know, it's just like
that was the second one.
Oh, was it? So, okay, so forget that, yeah. But you know, just certain scenes and films and lines and actors. So, yeah, an amazing podcast, an amazing hour spent just listening to stories. And I, in a way, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Can I hold up my book one more time?
Go for it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
There we go.
There you go. Yeah.
That's me, a little older, a little younger on the Mitchell BNC camera. And that's on the set of Doc, which was filmed in Spain in Almeria. And there's some good stories with that movie, too. So, what the camera didn't see, it's available on Amazon. Cheaper.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I picked my copy up from Amazon, and I would definitely, definitely, definitely recommend you doing the same if you are watching this video or listening to the audio version of the podcast. If you listen to the audio version, we'll make sure we put a link in there, and we'll also put a link on our website as well, so you can click on there, go to the blog post about this episode, and you can just click directly on and buy it from there, and it'll be delivered to your door in just a matter of days. So, Alec, thank you very much for joining us. Did you want to say your goodbyes to our listeners?
This has been great. Good questions. And it's nice to see that kind of enthusiasm that you guys bring to this.
Thank you. Gazza?
Yeah, an amazing episode. I've never really, we haven't done a podcast like this. We haven't really had anybody that's been in the presence of sort of acting royalty as such. So an amazing podcast, amazing just to hear Alec's sort of stories about being on set and with various sort of actors and actresses. And I've loved absolutely every single minute of it. So for me personally, Alec, thank you very much, and absolutely love the episode.
Indeed. I can't say any more than that, so I will finish it there, but just with one final urge. Go take a look at that book, head over to Amazon, click on the link that we're going to share, and pick yourself up a copy. I promise you won't regret it.